afternoon. So hopefully you're here for 3130, or else I went to the wrong room and someone let me plug in my laptop. So today we're going to be giving sort of an introduction and getting into our first topic. And this course covers a lot of systems related things, which I think is also true of 2130. And I'm trying to kind of consolidate the topics that are covered to give an overview, but this doesn't quite match precisely. So one thing, and our first topic, is going to be talking a little about automating building software, how libraries work, taking advantage of incremental compilation. So I think you know about object files, maybe from 2130, but talk about sort of more typical ways of using them and also what libraries are. We're gonna talk a bunch about sort of more how do we build operating systems and processors. And in that, we're gonna be looking at two big sort of services processors and operating systems kind of work together to provide. One of them is that we can share machines. Is that now, when we think of a machine like the department machines you log into, there's multiple users, and even on a single user machine, there's multiple programs on one system, and we need some support to make that happen and make that work in a reasonable way. We're going to talk about what that typically looks like, both sort of things the operating system needs to do and things the hardware needs to have to make the operating system reasonable to write. And we're going to talk about parallelism and concurrency, so doing more than one thing at a time. So multiple programs in one machine, that's kind of a version of more than one thing at a time. We're also going to spend a bunch of time talking about, well, what if I want a single program that does multiple things at a time? Either because, like, conceptually, it has two things to do. Like, if I think of a web browser, my web browser is, like, fetching data from a web server while it's displaying a web page. You know, those two things happening at the same time. Or because I want to take advantage of the fact that I know, oh, I have this thing called multiple cores. How do I use that? I understand in 2130 you use sockets, but didn't sort of go into anything about how they work. We're not going to go into like real detail. There's the networking course for that. We're going to give sort of a high level overview of what's going on to make that work. And we're also going to spend some time talking about things that processors do that are kind of mostly hidden from you to make them fast. That we have this kind of very simple model of how processors work, and we'll talk about a bunch of ways in which that is not how most high-performance processors are built, because it turns out that doing the things the simple way is not as fast as you can get by a big margin. So first talking about automating building software. So we're going to first talk about Make, which is probably the most traditional tool for automating building software. And our first lab next Wednesday is going to be about using Make. And sort of the idea of Make is that, you know, if I have a program, I edit a file, I type Make, and it figures out all the things I need to do to update that program based on what I just edited. Yeah, so that's automation where you don't have to type the commands. You don't have to figure out, oh, I used this to build a library and I need to build that library, then I need to rebuild the executable. Make should figure that out all for you and let you avoid do that without like recompiling everything every time, which is pretty essential if like you're working on a multi-million dollar piece of software, sorry, multi-million line piece of software. We're going to talk about how that works and also talk about maybe some more modern build systems very, very briefly, just that they exist. But generally, they kind of actually work in a similar way to Make, maybe with some more steps automated or automated in a different way. We'll talk about sharing machines. And a lot of this is going to be talking about support for operating systems to provide abstractions to programs, where programs kind of think they own the machine. And what I mean by that is when you write a program, you haven't written code probably, at least most of your programs, that assumes things about other programs on the machine, even though they're there and it seems like they might get in the way. Like other programs on the machines are using the memory. and you've never had to write your code like to, please, let's make sure I'm not accessing the memory of another program. That's not something you have to deal with explicitly, and it's not something you've seen in the compiler's assembly. Nothing about, like, let's make sure the stack doesn't grow into some other program's memory. That's not logic that's there. And what the operating system generally provides is this kind of what you might call a virtual machine, in the sense that it's kind of the machine your program has access to is, you know, nicer than the real machine and has kind of some things kind of simulated. And one of the things that's simulated is the memory. So you access memory locations, and the way that actually works is that your program is accessing memory locations will learn that we call virtual addresses, and that's not actually what the processor ends up using when it's talking to the memory. It goes this, puts it through this mapping that the operating system sets up to turn those into the real addresses, which you call physical addresses. And this applies to everything you access. So your code is located at these virtual addresses. All your pointers are using these virtual addresses. You never actually see physical addresses in your program. And that means you never have to worry about accidentally making an address that accesses processes B stuff. Because, well, if we go through this mapping, your program, there's no error here. You can't do it. And sort of this hardware support and the OS setting up these mappings carefully means that now our programs, you know, kind of look like they're, you know, independent of each other in the sense that they have their own memory. And this also means like that two programs can have two things that they think are at the same address, because, well, over here they're at the same address. But when multiple programs are running, they're going to have different mappings. So program B here, you know, it can put in, if it puts in 1,000, it will, might come up out as 2,000. If program A puts in 1,000, it may come out as 3,000. You know, so they're never going to interfere, and we can have the OS freely give them the actual same address without problems. So, and I just realized I forgot to start the video recording. Great. So we'll be missing the first few minutes of the video. Okay, so that's about address spaces, which is this notion of sort of a program having its own memory. Okay, and another theme we have is that, you know, we could say that we can do two things at once. And one sort of common example of doing two things at once is that you can run two programs at the same time. And one obvious way this could happen is that we could have multiple processors. So if you, we talked about, if you've heard about multiple cores, that means that we actually have physical hardware where one piece of hardware can be executing one instruction while another is executing another instruction, and they have their own registers and all that. That's straightforward. But we even do multiple things at a time when we don't actually have the hardware supporting. We don't, well, really do them at the same time. Instead, operating systems simulate this. So, like, example, if I'm running a program that asks for input from the keyboard, the way that's going to work is when the program's waiting for input from the keyboard, we're not just going to leave the processor sitting checking for input from the keyboard. Instead, we're going to have some way, which we'll talk about probably next week, where we can run other programs while it's waiting for the input using that same processor. And even when programs don't do something where they need to wait for some event, we're going to have some way where, let's say we're running a loop, you know, that we're not going to let the loop use all the time on the processor if there's other things to do. Instead, somehow the operating system is going to manage to run other things in the middle. So in this example, I have my infinite loop running. And from its perspective, it's just that between here and here, it just ran really slow. That's all it sees. But what actually happens is, you know, it didn't get to actually use the real processor, and we kind of gave this simulated processor that just doesn't run all the time. And by doing that, we can let other programs use the real processor in between those gaps. And this lets us, take one core and run hundreds of programs on it, and all the programs kind of are written as if they're written for a single core that runs all the time. Their code doesn't, have any calls that say, run another program now necessarily, but that's going to happen automatically. We'll talk about the hardware support and the operating system support to make that happen. Questions? And I showed you with one core, but this sort of thing will also apply with multiple cores. So if we have multiple cores, we're somehow going to divide up the time running on those cores between the programs that are running. So in this example, my compiler, I'm not going to let it use all the time. If there's the web browser needs some time, it's going to get some, perhaps. And also, we might have programs which use multiple of what we call threads, where they have not just one string of instructions to run, but several. And that's going to be a big topic we're going to talk about, is writing those programs in addition to sort of how they're run. Okay, so questions about sort of the high-level things we've talked about so far. So another thing we're going to talk about related to sharing machines is that we need to have some way of keeping you from doing certain things on machines. So if you log into the department machines and you try to access someone else's files, we expect that to fail. If you log into the department machines and try to shut them down, we expect that to fail. And we're going to talk about, what is the mechanism and sort of for doing that look like? How do we configure that? Who enforces those policies? So. We're also going to talk a bit about how sort of sockets work under the hood. So with sockets, you've kind of gotten this abstraction. I believe looking at the 2130 material, I'm sure as an aside, this class is going to be a learning experience for me to figure out what's actually taught in 2130, and also what's taught in 2130 that people remember, which I'm sure are different things. And I hope to navigate that. But I won't be surprised if I make some errors in assuming people have done things they haven't, or vice versa. So we're going to talk about what we'll call layers. So you have this kind of abstraction that you've dealt with where you get what I'll call streams, that you can send a stream of data, kind of like what you type in a terminal, that kind of stream to a remote machine. That's kind of the abstraction you've given. And it turns out that what this is built on top of doesn't actually support that, that the underlying networking hardware has sort of different pieces that implement the functionality to make that happen. And they don't actually implement sending a stream of data, they only implement sending small fixed amounts of data. And the thing that lets us send small fixed amounts of data has to be built on something that only knows how to send to machines that are on the same network as us, like in the same Wi-Fi range. And we somehow have to build that to let us talk to a machine that's, far away. So we're going to talk a bit about sort of the high level, how this works, and also how to construct kind of the stream abstraction you've seen from these lower level tools and make it work. We're not going to talk in really full detail. That's what a networking course is for. There's several topics most related to making this have good performance that we're going to skip over that are actually very important in a real network. That you'd like it, you'd like to be able to send data faster than a couple kilobytes a second. But we're not going to deal with those issues. And I'm sort of shown this as, we have, these four layers. So we have some kind of application protocol, like HTTP, where we have some way of specifying using the streams you've dealt with. I want to get a particular web page, for example. or we have a way of specifying, I want to open a shell for the SSH protocol. And we have this, what we call a transfer protocol, which implements something like that stream idea on top of a network protocol, which handles how do I get to the right machine across many networks, on top of some design called the, we'll call the link layer, that handles how do I communicate with things on the same network, like if we have three machines sharing a Wi-Fi network, how does that work? And this is an overly simplistic view, and commonly in practice, like, we actually have more layers in kind of an ad hoc way. So for example, HTTPS, we have an additional thing that's kind of an application layer to provide security. We'll talk a bit about how that works. And then there are protocols that run over HTTPS, like there's something called DNS on HTTPS that is actually used, like default in Firefox. That is another protocol on top of HTTPS, which is actually HTTP on top of TLS. And so people like kind of layer these things in practice all the time. Another example might be SCP or SFTP. It's like something running on top of SSH, which runs on top of TCP. So very commonly, there's this kind of mess of protocols over each other practice. So this kind of view that we have these layers is actually dramatically oversimplified because people don't always build their application protocol on top of TCP. Sometimes they build it on another application protocol. Actually very common. Okay, so that's on network layers. And another thing we're going to talk about that comes up most with networking, but also comes up elsewhere, is talking about related names and addresses. And like in some cases, this is kind of trivial. So like if you have a variable called counter in the assembly, well, maybe not in the assembly, in the machine code, that's not going to be called counter. It's going to have an address. Right, instead. And we have the same concept applying on networks a lot, where machines will have names like virginia.edu, and that's not the address because the name is not actually directly useful for the network to find the machine, just like the name counter isn't useful for the machine code to find the variable. So instead we have to find this address, and we'll talk a bit about how that works. And also with networking, we're going to talk a bit about security. So how do we make sure my socket's talking to who I think it is? How do I reason about like who could read the data on my socket? Like if someone's on the same Wi-Fi network, can they? When can it happen? How can we prevent that? How can we control that? Sort of our final theme here, talking about things under the hood of fast processors. So there's a lot of what processors do, which is implementing sort of two big ideas. One is caching, and the other is sort of parallelism in addition to the obvious parallelism that you're used to. So with caching, the idea is, well, I'll give an example here. So here's a dye photo. So this is a microscope photo of a processor from 2004. I chose the processor from 2004 because someone conveniently mapped out where the components of the processor are on this photo, and also it's a single core processor. And this is where on the processor the registers are. The registers are very fast to access. And there aren't many of them though. And if we want to access memory, that's going to go out of this thing here labeled the memory interface to some external chip. And that's going to be way, way, way slower than accessing the registers because, well, the registers are really close to all the stuff that does computation, right? They're actually, in this case, we have the integer registers right next to the thing labeled execution units, so that's the stuff that does integer computations. And the floating point registers are right next to this thing labeled the floating point unit, which does all the floating point computations. So that seems great. But if we want to get to our main memory, we have to go all the way off the chip and pretty far, and it's way, way slower. And also, main memory is way, way bigger, and it turns out sort of physically that if we have a bigger memory, it's probably a lot slower. and the registers are way smaller. So to avoid this, we have caches. And on these processors, what I have highlighted in orange here are level one caches. So this is space that are put on the processor, which is another memory. It's bigger than the registers, which means it's slower. It's also further away from the stuff that wants to do the computation, but it holds a lot more data than the registers. And the purpose of these caches is to hold things that would normally be in memory while we're working on them. And the processor tries to do this automatically, because when you're writing assembly code, you put things manually in the registers. You don't put things manually in the caches. You just access memory, and the processor is doing something under the hood to fill up these caches with the data you're using or the instructions you're using so that it doesn't have to talk to the slow memory. And on this processor, there's also an L2 cache, which is the whole right side of this chip. It takes up more space than the floating point unit. So this is like, you know, 8, 10 times bigger than the part of the circuit which implements floating point division. It's not trivial, but they decided it's worth devoting that space. And that's typical on modern processors. Modern processors often, in fact, have an L3 cache in addition to an L2 cache. But at the time, they felt that this design was most efficient for what they were doing. And we can kind of think of all these caches as forming kind of a hierarchy, which is often drawn in this pyramid, where at the top we have small and fast, at the bottom we have large and slow. And we get sort of very different performance at each level here. So registers, you know, are typically going to have a less than nanosecond access time. The L1 cache, because it's not much bigger than the registers, it's going to be slower, but it's going to be like a nanosecond-ish. And then we get, for the L2, like 5 nanoseconds. For processors that have an L3, it's probably like 20 these days. And main memory is something like 100. These are all like approximate, but we're usually like within a factor of 2 or so. And so there's a lot of work the processor needs to do to use these caches, since we're devoting a lot of space. And the idea is, if you do this right, most of the time, we're going to be using the L1 or L2 cache, and things are going to take 1 to 5 nanoseconds to access, not 100 to 20 to 100. And processors do a lot of work to make that happen. Yes?
Sorry, on this, where is the L3 cache?
So question, where is the L3 cache? So this 2004 processor only has an L1 and L2, but just like sort of the L2 is kind of like after the L1, some more recent processors often have an L3 cache in addition.
Yes, so more than one has L3.
So more than... So yeah, L3 cache would be the same idea as another level. So commonly on sort of a more recent processor, you'd have a chip that would have multiple cores. And the most common design is that each core, you'll have, let's say we'll have like core one, we'll have an L1 cache and an L2 cache. And same for every core, will have its own L1 and L2 cache, and it will have like a shared L3 cache, is the most common design that I see in a multi-core chip. So that's the most, so commonly there will be an additional L3 cache like shared between cores, but that's not the only possibility. And it's not unheard of to have systems with an L4 cache, though it's not common today. Basically, the decision on how many levels to have is done by looking at, if I run a typical program, can I make that program faster by adding more storage in some way? That's what processor designers are trying to do. And sometimes they find the answer is, yes, it's useful to add additional levels. Sometimes it's not. Other questions? And I said the other way in which processors can do the tricks is with parallelism. kind of as an example here, here I have two assembly functions. In the one on the right, so in both of these, I have a loop that runs 10 billion times. In the one on the right, there's one add instruction in the loop. In the one on the left, there's two. So you'd say, well, obviously, the one on the right should be slower. That this here, it has around 40 billion instructions to run, whereas this one has around 30 billion instructions to run. And when I time these on my desktop, I get that they take about the same amount of time. And this doesn't seem to make sense with the model of how processors work we have so far. Right? If we think of processors as fetch an instruction, do the instruction, move on to the next instruction, well, how could we fetch just as many instructions and run them, you know, or not fetch like not like 30% more instructions and take the same amount of time? And caching can't be the issue here because this code doesn't access memory except for the instructions, and it turns out, yes, we have to read the machine code for the instructions, but the caches will keep that in cache the whole time, regardless of the size. So there's something about how instructions are run which makes this happen. And sort of the high-level view of what's going on my desktop is that my desktop has the machinery to run several instructions at the same time and to fetch several instructions at the same time. And it ends up being the case that the thing that determines how fast this loop is probably that it has to do this decrement instruction 10 billion times, and you can't really do one decrement instruction before doing the next one. Can't do the next decrement instruction before you do the first, the previous one, because you need the output of the previous instruction. And so that determines the performance, is that it has to do one decrement instruction, then the next, and because it can do multiple instructions at a time, it ends up doing the add instructions kind of on the side in parallel. So we're gonna not talk like enough about how to like actually build a processor that does, but we're gonna give sort of a high level view of like what's really going on and try to give some ways of reasoning about what that means for how your code is executed. Okay. Okay, so questions about our themes. Yes?
Will time be distributed equally to them?
Question, will these be distributed equally? No, and I'm sure because this is my first time teaching the course, and also probably I should change things from the pilot, which was taught 2 years ago. You know, I suspect I'm probably not right about what will be taught in the future. That schedule is kind of more in flux than it would usually. Let's talk a bit about some logistics. So as you know from signing up for this class, there are labs. So for labs, you can attend lab in person and get checked off by a TA, or for most labs, there are some exceptions, you can submit something to the submission site and we'll grade it. If you submit something to the submission site, I don't care if you attended the lab. We are probably going to end up being more strict about submissions to the submission site than in-person checkoffs because we can't like ask you a question. If something just doesn't work for us, we're going to have to assume you didn't get it working rather than being able to figure out what went on. I'm going to try to have it roughly match like what the in-person checkoff will do, but I suspect it will end up being stricter just because, you know, we can't ask you questions. And we kind of have to assume that that's what you got and you tested it and it worked for you, or you didn't test it and you just submitted something and are hoping that we won't notice. Versus in labs, like, we'll ask you, well, what happened there? Why doesn't this command work? That sort of thing. But that's it. And if you do an in-person lab checkoff, you'll get at least 50% credit because the TA there will know that you like actually worked in the lab. For a submission, we may not do that. If I get a submission and it seems like, you know, you just barely started, my assumption is going to have to be, from what's submitted, I'm just going to have to say you probably just barely started, or even though someone, if you're in lab, they'll figure out, oh, that you had all these questions, and we can give you half credit then. So that's my plan. This is my first time doing any lab checkoff thing like this. I'm hoping it will work out okay, and I won't have to make adjustments. But my goal, basically, is that I want to have our TA time spent more on students needing help rather than checking off labs that are completely done, and so on.
This one's like going to be like an auto grader type situation where we can like submit and see if it worked, or is it kind of like submit and people know?
The question is the submission site going to be an auto grader situation? I'm probably not for every assignment. And often when I write auto graders, the way it works is that it will like grade it if it makes sense, and if it doesn't make sense, it will punt it for a human to grade. So some of them, even that are mostly auto-graded, might end up, if something's weird with your submission, it might, instead of getting like a bad grade from the auto-grader, it will go to some TA or me to look at. And obviously, that's not going to have like 1 hour turnaround. It's going to take a few days. Other questions? Yeah. Once you submit it, can you resubmit it? Yes. We will grade your last submission. We will grade your last submission generally. Yes?
Are the labs like generally designed to be finishable in the 75
lab? Question is, the labs generally designed to be finishable in lab? Yes, that is our intention. We are grading labs and being complete, but our intention is that they're finishable in the lab time. For some of these labs, it might be the first time we're doing them. We might have made substantial changes from the last time they were done, so things might not work out. I'll deal with it on a case-by-case basis. Yeah?
Can we attend a different lab than the one we signed up for?
I don't want to enforce that sort of attendance, but the room our labs are in has a fire code capacity of 90. So if it gets too crowded, we're going to have the TA say, sorry, if you're not in the lab, go away. Also, if there's like too many people asking for help, we're going to prioritize people actually signing up for that lab time. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So if we work on something in lab and we don't complete it during the time, does it work with submitting afterwards? And like, does that get back to 100% credit? Or?
Question, if you don't finish something in the lab time, can we submit it afterwards? Yes. And my deadline for submissions to the submission site will be midnight on the lab day. And there will be a late policy after that. Yes?
So then it would just be, if we don't finish it during the lab, it would just be on the submission site, there's no like in-person check-off?
The question is, there's no late in-person check-off? That is correct. If you're sick or something like that, we can arrange a late in-person check-off, but for sort of, there's no questions asked late in-person check-off. We expect you to submit something if that's possible. Yes? Question, the website will accept lab submissions through midnight of the lab day. So we will consider, where is my slide for this? We will consider, if lab submissions are due 11:59 p.m. of the lab day. But our normal late policy, which is that apply, same late policy as for homeworks, will apply to labs where you last submission. So you can submit it late for some significant partial credits. Yeah?
So if my lab is on Wednesday, the last submission is due at 11:59
p.m.? Question, if our lab is on Wednesday, lab would be due 11:59 p.m. on Wednesday? Yes. Yeah?
If you get
it checked off in the lab, do you still submit it? Nope, we don't care. You can, but as long as you got full credit from the checkoff, you will. If you got partial credit from the checkoff, so if your TA said you barely finished anything, give you a 50, you can submit it and we'll take the highest grade. Yes? Question, isn't this not great for lab time distribution? It's not preferable. I don't know of a great solution. My hope is that things are finished for in the lab time physically, so it's not a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember, so for the last CS01, last fall and last spring, like we have a week for the lab to check off. But here now we have only like 6 hours, like if we want to finish it.
So the question is about late labs. Yes, I am expecting late submissions to be done in less than a week for credit, yes. That is a deliberate choice. I've had bad experiences with late policies which let people be a week behind on assignments. So even though I've done that in the past, I'm trying to avoid it. Yeah.
When will lab assignments be released?
Generally, my hope is no later than the first lab, obviously. My hope is like after we cover the course, any corresponding lecture material.
So we will have like 4 to 6, like, I guess how much time?
Yeah, so my hope is when we cover any corresponding lecture material, so should be no later than, you know, Tuesday evenings. And usually earlier, but I'm not going to release a lab that we haven't covered in the lecture because, like, if I don't get to the right lecture stuff, I'm going to change the lab. I have the lab. I'll try to have like the tentative versions of the lab up, but there might be a lot of changes to them for obvious reasons. But you can certainly look at the tentative versions, and for the most part, it will probably help you. If you finish that, you'll be mostly done with the real lab. Yeah. Are any labs going to be dropped? I'm not planning on doing that because I allow late lab submission. Other questions? Okay. So, okay, and also, yes, some labs are going to basically require attendance through We Know submission. So for example, there's a lab where we want you to code review other people's code. That's not really something we can do with a submission. And if you can't attend the lab, you know, talk to us and we'll figure something out, but you know, we can't really have you submit something to code review someone else's code. That's not how it works. For labs, collaboration of labs is permitted. You can work with other people. If you're submitting code, please put a comment or something indicating who you work with. But you are welcome and encouraged to work with other people, ideally, preferably other people in the lab, but other people in the class, on the lab, and that is 100% fine. If you're submitting instead of doing a checkoff, each of you does need to submit. We're not gonna like read the comment to figure out who you worked with. Like, if one of you forgets to submit, we can probably figure it out, but you know, obviously we won't do that automatically. Yeah.
Is it okay for the lab code to be largely the same if we collaborate?
Question, if you collaborate, is it okay for you both to submit the same code? Yes. Yeah, you can submit the same file. That would be fine. Other question?
What programming language do you expect most of the class to be in?
Question, what programming language do you expect most of the class to be in? Probably a majority C. Other lab related questions. So we'll have quizzes. There will be weekly quizzes. And these quizzes will be worth more than you're used to from CS01 because I'm not doing midterms. So the quizzes instead will be worth considerably more because there's no midterms for that. Quizzes were released in the evening, Thursday after lecture, starting next week, not this week, in the evening, because if I don't get to what I think I'm supposed to get to in lecture, I need to change the quiz, and I like to have time to do that. And they'll be due 15 minutes before the lecture on Tuesday. Yes? Question, are they timed? They are untimed, open book, open notes, open internet. Yes, and they're untimed, you can open it up. Wait, you can open it up once, answer some questions, go back later, change your answers. It's whatever you have submitted by 15 minutes before lecture. It all counts. that will be about the lecture and or lab material from the prior week generally. 4 to 6 questions, short answer or multiple choice generally. I'll go over the system we're using and so on later. So since they're open book, open notes, you can look up resources, tutorials, etc. You can't like ask Stack Overflow the quiz question. You can't I am your friend the quiz question, but resources yourself. We're not going to give you the answers to the quiz questions in office hours, but we will gladly answer questions about lecture slides, examples in lecture, examples in the readings, things like that. We're just not going to like actually answer the quiz question. Yes? What's the quiz format? 4 to 6 questions, short answer like a number or multiple choice.
Are we able to write comments on the quiz question?
Are you able to write comments on the quiz question? Yes, so I'll be using a quiz system, which may or may not be one you've used before in 2130, that lets you write comments, and that is going to be the official way if you think a question is ambiguous, because if someone tells me on Sunday the question is ambiguous, I don't think it's very nice to send an announcement to the class telling people who did the quiz on Friday, sorry, you have to look at it again. So I'm just going to have people write comments if they think the question has some problem, and we'll deal with it in grading, we'll drop questions if we need to, we'll make additional answers on the key, correct if we need to, and so on. Yeah. Question regrade, there will be, you can submit for any assignment, you can tell me that you graded it wrong and I will take a look at it. And we'll have a way to do that. Other questions? Okay, so we have homeworks. There are several homework assignments. The homework assignments are done individually. Unlike the labs, you can collaborate with whoever homeworks on your own. The due times I've set for them are generally just before the first lab. The intention of this is that I don't want people going to lab and having the main topic of the lab be the homework. Like, you have office hours for that. I'm kind of disappointed with how related the labs and homeworks are, which I understand is also kind of a problem in 2130. But I don't think I'm fixing that this semester, since I have enough with, you know, redoing the pilot course, and also I have a bunch of my own changes to make to assignments, and things like that. And there's one final exam, which will be in person at our official scheduled exam time. There are no midterms. Instead, the quizzes count for a lot, and there's slightly more homeworks than in the pilots. Homeworks and labs than in the pilot. Yes?
Will there be any opportunities to retake quizzes?
No. We will drop the lowest quiz, but we'll not allow retakes. Yeah?
For the homework submission time, is that like Wednesday morning?
Question is that Wednesday morning? The first lab is at 2 p.m., so that would be 1:59 p.m. Yes?
Can you release the exams from the pilot for practice?
Can I release the exams from the pilot for practice? I need to investigate that. In that I don't know if I have access to them. I don't know what the Luther Tkanovich says about reusing those questions, so I need to check. Yeah. What, sorry? What's the structure of the exam? I haven't written it yet, so I don't know. Generally, it would probably be multiple choice short answer and maybe a few longer answer questions. When I write an exam, I usually target it to fit comfortably in the time. Sometimes I don't succeed at that. So I would hope like it would be an exam where most people are done after 90 minutes. Though whether I hit that target or not varies. Yeah.
It is possible to have coding questions in the final.
Question is possible to have coding questions in the final? Yes. It's also possible to have coding questions on the quizzes. Yeah.
Are the relative
weights for all of these things kind of up in the air? And if so, are we going to like...
Question, are the relative weights for all of these things up in the air? Do I have that slide? No. There are... on the course website's policy page, it says quizzes 30%, labs 15%, homeworks 40%, final exam 15%. And the promise I make with respect to grading is that if your weighted raw score is at least a 90, that's an A-, at least an 80, that's a B-. I will look at how those scores actually happened at the end of the semester and decide if I want to make it more generous than that. And I'm gonna do that instead of like trying to re-rate the quizzes or the final exam, like I'm just gonna give the raw score you get on those. And, oh, so development environment. So we're gonna use the department machines via SSH or NX remote desktop. That is the officially supported environment. You can probably do a lot on your own machines in a Linux environment, but if it doesn't work, we're probably not helping you. At least, you know, if there's 10 people in office hours and you're asking for help with your VM, I'm gonna say use the department machines. I need to help the other 9 people. Because we have like people who are paid by the department we can contact if something doesn't work with SSH or NX, and not so much if we're supporting VMs or Windows subsystem for Linux and so on. That's kind of extra time our TAs have. And I haven't checked assignments on an OXX or Windows machine, so they might not work. So for getting help, we have office hours. There will be a calendar posted on the website. I have some office hours posted tomorrow. I will have office hours next week, but I need to figure out what meetings I need to schedule them around. The office hours will be a mix of in-person and remote, which will be indicated on the calendar, whether it's remote or it's in-person. Remote will use a Discord and an online queue. And in-person office hours may or may not use that online queue. Look for like something written on a whiteboard in the room that it ends up being scheduled in. Probably we're gonna try to have like really late office hours, like after 7 p.m. be remote, and probably most other office hours be in person, and maybe some other times that are relatively unpopular be remote to get a little more attention. We have Piazza, and you can use private questions if you have homework and code. You can also email me. That's probably the least effective way of getting help, but I will read my emails. And office hours are posted now, but they should be soon, and we'll figure out what rooms things are in over the next week or so. Okay, and late policy. Late quizzes won't be accepted. The main reason for this is I expect to be talking about the quiz answers here during lecture 15 minutes after they're due. So can't really let you submit answers after going through in detail why the answer is what it is. One quiz is dropped unconditionally. Last word. For homeworks, if your homework is 0 to 48 hours late, we'll give you 90% credit. There's no sliding scale there. 1 hour is the same as 47. If it's 48 to 72 hours late, we'll give it 80% credit. If it's later than that, we're not gonna give you credit, generally. For labs that allow submission, same policy will apply as homeworks, and the submission time will be 11:59 p.m. For other labs, the policy will be on a lab-by-lab basis. Probably it's gonna be the sort of thing where we need to talk about what a makeup would look like. Excused absences. So if you have special circumstances, you shouldn't need to rely on the late policy. Talk to me. If you're ill, you have some sort of emergency that requires going to be with family or something, let me know, preferably as soon as you can, and we'll figure something out. Please, don't go to lab if you're sick. We can make it work. And attendance, I won't take attendance in lecture. I will attempt to have lecture recordings. Apparently, I forgot to record the first 7 minutes of video, which maybe I'll try to reconstruct that. So sometimes there may be issues with recording, but I'm going to do my best to actually have lecture recordings. Okay, so questions about logistics. Yeah.
How do you pronounce your last
name? How do I pronounce my last name? Rice. Other questions? Yeah.
For the quizzes, just like typing stuff like an IDE or like Nano Lab?
Question for the quizzes, can you run stuff in an IDE or things like that? Absolutely. Yes, the quizzes are, yes, also open compiler. Which, you know, they're that because I don't feel like I'm going to actually stop you from doing that. You probably don't actually want that because that means the kind of questions I need to write sometimes going to have to be things where having a compiler won't help you. Other questions? Yeah.
Did you consider having the lab to do like 24 hours after your lab time instead of the night
to do? Could I consider having labs do 24 hours after lab time instead of the night to do? I'll talk to my TAs about it and think about it. Probably making it your lab time is logistically very hard for me, but I could consider having it due sometime on Thursday. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
One more thing I asked you to consider, but you already sort of said some reasoning about this makes sense, but you could release labs a little earlier than Tuesday night.
Question, can I release labs earlier than Tuesday night? So I expect in practice most labs will be released a lot earlier than Tuesday night. For example, if you look at next week's lab, there's something labeled tentative. I don't think it's going to change, but the lecture material is my next set of slides. And if for some reason we didn't get to that or something, I would want to change the lab. And that's usually the only reason it's likely to be like not right the previous week. There might be some exceptions. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So with logistics out of the way, let's talk a bit about building programs. So this is sort of a diagram of what building a program here. So here I have a program where I have main.c, main.h, I have an extra.c and extra.h. Extra apparently uses standard I/O, like printf. And I build it into a program called program. And that program needs things like printf. So at runtime, it loads libc.so, which is the system file that contains the code for printf. So it turns out that sort of the default way of compiling and building programs does what's called dynamic linking. So let's look at what these steps are. So here, when I make main.o and extra.o, which I think you've done before, the compiler, you know, in this case it's Clang, is reading main.c and extra.c, and when it reads main.c, it sees in main.c that it includes main.h and extra.h, so it combines those all together to make main.o. And similarly, when it's making extra.o, it reads extra.c, and the extra.c tells it needs to read extra.o. And I believe you explored a bit that maybe you could have an extra step here where we make some assembly files. And that's actually what's turned into that O file. I'm going to skip that step on most of our diagrams and kind of pretend it goes just all from C and H files into object files. But we know sort of under the hood there's really this extra assembly step or something like it. Questions? Okay. And then we make a program from this. So in this case, I invoke my compiler and tell it to put main.o and extra.o together into program. And it's actually going to put some other, a few extra files in here I have labeled as system files. So for example, on Linux, the program, when you run program, it doesn't actually start at main. It starts at some other function that's in these system files. And that function calls me. So there's some extra files involved to make this execute. And in the default way things work, this program, it includes some of these files, system files, and main.o's code and extra.o's code, but it doesn't actually include a lot of the code for the standard library. So for example, printf is not going to actually be in program. If you look at the machine code that's in there, you won't find the machine code for printf, even if it calls printf, probably. And that's going to be in some other file that's loaded at runtime. So when I run program, it's going to load this file called libc.so, that contains the actual code for printf and things like that. Questions about what goes on with building our program? Yes?
So
question, if printf isn't in program, where?
So if these system functions aren't in the program executable, then how does it get generated at runtime? Where does that come from?
Question, if the system programs aren't in the program executable, how does it get generated at runtime? So the program is going to have, you know, basically an annotation which says needed libc.so. It won't actually be written like this because there's some binary format, but it's basically going to have something which says this needs libc.so to run. And part of the code that runs when loading an executable like this is going to look at those list of annotations and find libc.so somewhere. And it's going to open that file and load it into the program's memory. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
What does the .so mean? Is that system object?
Question, what does .so mean? So SO stands for shared object. And you can conclude that's because, well, lots of programs are using libc.so. And also, as we might discuss a little when we talk about how address spaces works, we talk about like there's this mapping for a program. Oftentimes, the system will arrange for if two programs both have libc.so loaded, they'll actually share that memory so we avoid wasting space. So we'll only have one copy of the printf function if two programs are using it, even though they're separate executables. Other questions? Yeah.
So like back in like 2130 when we were like installing C, if you will, is that like one of the files that we would have like gotten when we were doing that?
Sorry?
It's like when we were like installing C, if you will, like the setup for last like 2130, is that like one of the files that we would have gotten?
So the question is, when you're installing C, is this one of the files you would have gotten? So I'm not sure what installing C exactly means.
Like getting set up to be able to run like C program.
I assume on your own machine.
Yeah.
So usually, probably libc.so would not be. And that's because this is a file that is needed for like normal programs you have installed. Right, because this is a file that's used when you run something like ls. I should note, I'm giving the Linux version of things. Things are going to be different on like Windows OS X. In particular, no one seems to agree on what dynamically loaded libraries extensions should be. Linux uses .so, Windows uses .dll, Mac OS X uses .dylib, and there are a few others I've heard of too. But it would be a file already installed because so many programs need it. Now, there would be some files you would have installed that are in this diagram, like the system files here that are included, like called main, you might have been installing those. And sometimes there might be some files that help the compiler find the right libc.so that might be installed. But sort of the actual sort of code probably is already there because so many other applications you already have installed need it. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So this is labeled dynamic linking. So you might say, if I'm specifying dynamic linking, I must have some other type of linking to talk about. And I do, something called static linking. So in static linking, most things look the same, but instead of having our program load things at runtime, we have it load, have all the code for printf and such built into the program. And so for this, we have this libc.a, which, you know, this is used in place of libc.so. And for producing this executable, we'd run a command like clang minus static minus o program. And the options were used too. Yes?
Is static linking faster than dynamic linking?
Question, is static linking faster than dynamic linking? So doing the linking itself, almost certainly not, like producing the program. Running the program, that's a complicated question. Because there are kind of pros and cons here. So the biggest con is that if we think of a system running like 20 programs, with dynamic linking, it's easy for the operating system to only actually load one copy of libc into memory. With static linking, probably it's going to end up loading 20. On the other hand, with dynamic linking, the machine code needs to be a little bit different to support calling the functions that are loaded, and that might be a little bit slower. But in practice, probably the bigger reason people choose between static and dynamic linking isn't performance, but it's kind of a reliability thing. That when you do static linking, you're guaranteed that someone updating this system file called libc.so won't break your program because you don't use it. When you use dynamic linking, that's not going to happen. On the other hand, if you use dynamic linking, if someone updates libc.so to fix a bug, the bug's fixed in your program for free. With static linking, you need to recompile, or sorry, relink your program to do that. And those sort of reliability considerations are probably more of why people choose between static and dynamic linking. Yes?
What do A stand for in the libc?
Question, what does A stand for in the libc? It stands for archive. And static libraries, like libc.a here, are another thing where no one had reason what extensions to use. But a.a is most common in Unix. And I have my table of file extensions here with some alternatives from Windows. I guess I can write the alternative from OS X. is.dylib. Yeah, and I guess there's some others you might see out there. I think I've seen like titusolib. There's more of these, but the main ones I have here are the ones you see on Linux. And our .a file, our statically linked library on Linux, it's actually just a collection of .o files with an index. And by a collection, I mean literally. .a is an historical archive format like zip. So it's basically, it's similar to like a zip file with an index. It's not quite that, but that's almost what it is. But a .so file, something more complicated has happened to make it possible to quickly load. So questions about our types of files that are involved here? Yes?
Static linking, why is it loading a .a instead of just loading all the old
Question, why is it loading a .a file instead of just loading all the O files? It's basically just a shorthand to avoid having to type all, have to specify all the O files.
What if like you need like an O file in this hard drive and another hard drive?
Question, what if I need O files from two different .a's? Then you ask for both the .a's. And because the .a file is a collection of .o files, the linker potentially can avoid including .o files that you don't actually use from them. Whether it does that or not probably depends on the system, but that's something that's relatively easy for it to do. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So for libc, I assume it loads all like a wide array of commands and functions, right? Would it be, if you're trying to optimize on a very small level, would it be better to load only certain .o files instead of the .a, if that makes sense?
The question, if you're trying to optimize, would it be better to like specify the .o files you want? So probably the linker either already does that for you, or you can pass an option to have it do that for you. Because that is pretty straightforward to do. For it to figure out, oh, you're asking for printf, here's the thing that you implements printf, let's look for that .o file, let's see what other .o files it needs. The linker can do that work. Whether it does that by default or not might vary, but it definitely can do that, and you shouldn't like need to specify yourself. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we talked about static libraries. So static libraries on Unix conventionally are called something like libfoo.a, where foo is kind of the name of the library. And it is literally an archive of .o files with an index. That is the format they've chosen. Some systems might have a more complicated format. And to create them, you typically use the r command for archive. My understanding is at the time that this was made, archive was the standard Unix archive utility. And by the time this was made, I probably mean like in the 70s. But use this utility, and this would be the typical command to do it. Oh, I forgot an important part of this command. And you need to specify the output file. And that's the command. And then to link to it, typically what people do is use this syntax here, where we specify a place to find libraries. So in this case, if /path to lib is where libfoo.a is, I'm specifying that. And then I specify just kind of the base name of the library, the foo part. And there's a default set of places that are searched for libraries. So if it's a library that's kind of installed in the system, you won't need a -L option. It'll just work because it's in a standard directory like user lib on Linux. So questions? Yeah.
What does the RCS do? Creating?
Question, what is the RCS? Let me up the C is create, and C is create, right, so looking in the man page, the R is insert, the C is create, and the S is with index. Most people don't actually care and just remember the look up the command and use it. But yes, so the gliders do mean something. Does that answer your question? Yeah, and I guess I would note that our AR has a manual page which is readable. Yeah.
What is the flag in
LFU? What is the flag LFU? So the format is L and name. So this is so the L part is library, and you just write the name of the library without any spaces, is the typical way it's done. Your compiler might also support some other ways that are perhaps more readable. I'm just showing the most common Unix syntax for it. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So for shared libraries, generally you'd so there's a special step that's not needed with static libraries, which is that the O files you use to make a shared library need to be compiled differently. So the typical option is with Clang and GCC is -fpic. With other compilers, maybe it's different. And this stands for position independent code. And the idea here is that the location at which your shared library is loaded could be different depending on what executable uses it. And it turns out that we need to write the assembly different to handle that. And so this option tells the compiler to do that. And after you've done that, with GCC and Clang, you can use the -shared option and specify and .so file numbers. And then using it works the same way as with static libraries. You specify the directory to look in, and this -l and the name of the library to look for option. So that option looks for both static or shared libraries, whatever ones. If it finds a shared one, it will use that. If it only finds a static one, it will use that. And the compiler will choose between the two based on whether you're doing static or dynamic linking for your overall executable. Yes?
For the first line, are you compiling source into the .o files with FPIC?
Question, for the first line, am I compiling the source into the .o files with -fpic? Yes, so it would be, this step would need -fpic. Other questions? Okay, so this is building a program that uses a shared library. So because shared libraries do work at runtime, sometimes there's a little bit of extra step to do afterwards. So when we actually run the program, it's gonna look for, in this case, libfoo.so. And it's gonna look for it in the standard locations it looks for libraries. And you might say, wait a moment, I passed -l path to lib. Why isn't it looking there? I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. Some other OSs work that way. Linux and most other OSs you're probably likely to come across don't. You aren't using Solaris, which did work that way. So if you wanted to find the library, you can either put it in one of those standard locations, or you can override the locations it searches. Two common ways of doing that are an environment variable called LD library path. If you don't know what environment was, you need to look it up. It's something you can set in the shell when you're running the program. Or when you're making the executable, you can use an option like this to specify what's called a runtime search path, which will be embedded in the executable saying, in addition to searching the standard places, search this directory when you're looking to load libraries. Yeah.
So if it finds the library, let's say, both in the standard directories and in the runtime path you specify, which one will it?
Question, which one it will use if the library's in multiple locations? It's going to search them in some order, and I'm not actually sure what order that is. And whichever one it finds first, that's what it's going to use. Okay. Great questions. Okay, and yeah, I guess we have time for this exercise. So here, I'm doing the same building program from main.c and extra.c. So first question, let's say I change main.c. What commands should I rerun? I have three commands there. So who thinks I should rerun command one? Thinks I should rerun command two? Thinks I should rerun command three? Okay, so most people, not everyone, said one and three, and I would agree. Right? We need to rebuild main.o since main.c changed, but we also need to keep going. We need to rebuild the program to incorporate the main.o change. And the way we can think of this is that I changed main.c up here, and I need to make main.o change, and I need to keep going and rebuild the program. So we're going to talk about automating this process of rerunning the right commands as our first topic next time.